yesterday we sketched three positions that Christians have taken in the past with respect to this overriding issue of the use of force, especially the moral dimensions of the use of deadly force, of killing violence. And then we looked at some representatives of each of those three positions, the crusader position, the just war position, and the pacifist position, took a look at some of the ethical issues involved in each, especially those raised by the relationship of ends and means. I want today to do something different. With these sessions and people having different schedules in each day, I've tried to put together sessions which would sort of stand on their own and at the same time be meaningful if people could get to several in a sequence. So I want to do something a little bit different today and not carry on that sketch of those positions, but ask about the theological dimensions of this issue of the use of violence. However, I think it's only fair for those of you who were here yesterday for me to ask if there are comments or questions sort of left over from yesterday that we should take up before we start this round. Something that might have occurred after we dismissed.
I just wanted to share what I think I told Esther, that I think the selective just war position allows for more human weakness and shadings of gray than the absolute pacifist position. Mm-hmm. But that the absolute pacifist position is sort of the ideal, like you mentioned, like the lure for progress.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, that's the just war people have said that it's precisely that sort of shadings of gray that one must come to terms with in history as Christians. We're going to talk a little bit today about Niebuhr's position. There are people in the just war position who affirm the absolute pacifist position as well. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into that in a minute. Sort of as to conclude yesterday and put everybody on board in taking off today, let me say that I think it's fair to say there is a rough consensus in the literature in Christian ethics on this matter. The crusader position doesn't get a good hearing in that literature in Christian ethics, which holds it up to critical assessment because of that relationship of ends and means. I know of no Christian ethicist who says the crusader position is morally legitimate, namely that you only have to show the justice of ends, and that all means are justifiable in attaining just ends. I know of no one who says that. Doesn't mean Christians don't do that. Lots of examples of doing that, but I take it that Christian ethics isn't established by taking a Gallup poll of what Christians do. In any case, yeah.
Well, I kind of have a question. I was thinking about how do you view the, well, I know it was prior to Christ, but God's dealings with the nation of Israel, with the Hebrew people, and that they very definitely, in many, many, many situations, it was ends justified the means.
It was holy wars.
Yeah, the holy
wars. Yeah. That's interesting. Question, and when you ask a tough question like that, the usual response of a teacher is to say, well, what do you think about that? where the teacher doesn't know how to reply. This book, The Politics of Jesus, which is in the bookstore by John Howard Yoder, is one of the most challenging pieces I've read in a long time on an understanding of biblical materials around the whole question of violence and nonviolence. The book is not directed toward that. It's a full treatment of the meaning, significance of the life and death of Jesus. But it also is a defense of the pacifist position. And in there, Yoder says that if you look at the Old Testament materials carefully, there is a direct relationship between trust in Yahweh and the means used by the Hebrews in their going in the Promised Land and going to the Promised Land. And at the times when their confidence is fullest in Yahweh, that those times they assume that God will fight for them, and that they ought not to take up arms. When they are doubting the kingship and the leadership of Yahweh is at the times when they take it in their own hands. Now, if Yoder is right, then that's kind of interesting. I think that that does not, however, well, I think that doesn't really yet come to terms with something which is very troublesome for pacifists, at least, and I should think for all Christians, namely that the Bible is full of something you could call the violence of God. And even the talk of the future is cast in those terms, that somehow or another it belongs to the working out of things in accord with the will of God, that great suffering, destruction, violence takes place. And I don't know of, and that doesn't mean that there isn't any, I'm just saying I don't know, of treatments of the violence of God in the Old and New Testament by pacifists that really, really come to terms with that question.
Yeah, I was thinking, for example, this morning I was reading in 2 Samuel, and at one point they're transferring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, and I can't remember the guy's name, but he was, you know, they were pushing it on a cart, and they kind of hit a bump, you know, and he reached out to steady the Ark of the Covenant, and they said that Yahweh became, you know, very angry, and he struck the guy dead at the moment. He said that he did that. He struck him dead because of what he had done, reaching out and touching the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I thought that was a really vivid example.
The vivid example of what you're talking about. That is another example of something that I think must be come to terms with. I just don't know how that would be dealt with, other than the way in which Yoder has done with respect to the whole question of the holy wars, and says that there's a direct relationship to their confidence in Yahweh, and toward the end, and they always resort to arms and violence when that confidence in Yahweh, that he will fight for them, when that is lacking. That still doesn't answer the question of the violence of God.
Yeah, it seems a really strange understanding of, you know, their commandments, like David's understanding, for instance, following him through all this understanding of the commandments, you know, like, wow, he really, well, there's no doubting that he had absolute faith in God, you know, and worshipped him and loved God, just, you know, and wanted to be God's man from the bottom of his heart, and yet his means were always like, it was like, thou shalt not kill just doesn't apply to anybody except maybe he's in your immediate family or something.
Well, this is why Bainton says that you find the antecedents or the precedents or the examples of all three of these positions, crusader, just war, and pacifist, in the scriptures. Were you going to say
something? Where does Yoder deal with the Holy Wars, isn't that?
Yeah.
Okay.
It isn't extensive, but it's suggestive. Okay, I was saying that the ethical issue involved in the crusader position, namely that just ends justify whatever means are necessary to attain them, doesn't hold up in the literature of Christian ethics as a position which is worthy of the Christian's allegiance. Now, after you've said that and kind of written off the crusader position, I think one still has to take some note of it along the lines of the remark by Roland Bainton that in the Christian, that there's a kind of single-mindedness about that position that the Christian ought to pay attention to. What Bainton means is that any campaign of any significance for establishing social good, for overcoming social injustice, does require, at least psychologically, something of the crusader mentality. So that even a pacifist, of which Bainton is one, says that there's something right in the drive and the single-mindedness and the general mentality of a crusade, so that one talks about the war on poverty or something like that, which becomes has that kind of drive. And even William James, who was also a pacifist, says that we need to find in our campaigns for social good the moral equivalent of war.
The most powerful singing here this week, I feel, was on
the Christian soldiers. Yeah.
I said
yeah.
We belted that thing out enough to chip granite.
Yeah. So there is something in this about the whole crusader position. I'm not talking about just ends and means now. I'm just talking about a seeming kind of necessity for the moral equivalent of war. That is, in our campaigns for good, we need that kind of dedication and drive. All right. Now, there isn't a consensus in the literature in Christian ethics about which of the other two positions, just war or pacifist position, is most in keeping with the Christian faith. That is simply an ongoing debate, which of those two best represents what the gospel is about. That, however, should not obscure for us a very important point, a point where there is consensus, namely that both of them share a very strong presumption against the use of violence by Christians, namely that you must have an exceptionally strong case for even the exceptional use of violence. Karl Barth, who himself adhered to the just war position, said, I don't have the quotation, but because I don't have the volumes at hand, but something roughly like this. The Christian who doesn't begin with the conviction that pacifism is almost surely right has not understood the action of God in Christ. If we don't begin with the presumption that the pacifist represents the pacifism represents the embodiment of the gospel, then we haven't begun in the right place at all as Christian. So in a sense, and the just war people are saying this, in a sense, the just war position is an exception from pacifism, which is the norm. I really want to underscore that, because the Christians have, I think, even in our language, not really seen that point. When we say selective conscientious objection, we aren't really catching what is at stake here. Selective conscientious objection sounds something like this. One assumes that when the state calls us to participate in war, or let's imagine being a policeman or something other that might entail the use of deadly violence or the threat of that, one assumes that one ought to follow that or obey that command to participate, and then maybe there will be a particular war which will cause us to make exception from obeying that command. In other words, you start there with the presumption that the use of violence is legitimate, and there may be certain kinds of circumstances where that's not legitimate, and the Christian ought to pay attention at that point. That is a common sort of understanding among, there has been a common understanding among Christians, especially at the point of response to the draft or something like that. What I'm saying is that we, according to the picture of these positions, just war and pacifism, we ought rather to talk not so much about selective conscientious objection to a norm which says use of violence is morally legitimate. One might, however, selectively object to it. We ought to talk about something like selective conscientious participation, where we say pacifism is the norm, and some circumstances might arise where one has to make an exception from pacifism. So it's a selective participation in the use of violence rather than a selective objection to it. And what I'm really underscoring here is that that is true for both the just war, that is shared by both the just war and pacifist position, namely that the presumption is that the pacifist position is the normative one. And of course there's still a huge gulf. The pacifist says you should never deviate from the norm. The just war advocate says under certain circumstances and if certain criteria are met, which we talked about yesterday, then a deviation is legitimate. Okay, but to sort of underscore it even again, I think that the Bard is right on the nose. Anybody that doesn't begin with the conviction that pacifism is almost surely right hasn't understood the action of God in Christ. Now, the thing that I want to pick up then for today is to ask about these two positions, just war and the gospel and pacifism, and their relationship to the gospel. Are there core issues in the Christian faith that are at stake in choosing one position or the other? Does the gospel, and by that I just mean that's just sort of shorthand for talking about the heart of the matter for a Christian faith. Does the gospel, so to say, tilt in favor of one or tilt in favor of the other? A way to get at this is to talk about people, and I have selected two persons, each of whom is regarded as probably the most sophisticated or strongest advocate of representative of the of each of these two positions, at least in their writings. There have been few defendants of the just war position that have been so compelling as Reinhold Niebuhr, so I'm going to pick Niebuhr for that one. There have been few advocates of the pacifist position that have been so compelling as John Howard Yoder, a new person on the scene, but one that you should get acquainted with, and I again hold up the book, The Politics of Jesus, as a place to get into Yoder. I am not going to assume any familiarity with either of these two on your part. I just use them as a device for talking about what are the issues, the theological issues in these two positions. There is a lot of agreement between Niebuhr and Yoder, and that's significant. So let's talk about areas of agreement and areas of disagreement. Both of them would say that there are indeed great issues at stake in choosing one or the other position as a Christian, great issues that go to the heart of the meaning and the significance of the Christian faith. In fact, with both of them, you don't really start with a commitment to pacifism or a commitment to the just war position and then move to a full understanding of the Christian faith. Rather, each of them starts with what a full sort of explication of the meaning of the Christian faith and sees the pacifism or the just war position as an outcome of those. That's important. There are a lot of pacifists and just war position people who have their mind made up about the use of violence and nonviolence and then sort of understand the faith in light of that. What I'm saying is that both of these understand their positions in light of the faith. But the reverse side of that is to say that those two positions then become significant theologically as well, because you just go back from there to the heart of the faith itself. For Yoder, pacifism then isn't the norm for understanding the gospel, but pacifism is a correlate for Yoder of his understanding of the meaning and the significance of Jesus Christ. And he understands discipleship as participation and imitation of Christ that involves non-resistance. And if one is a Christian and follows Christ, then one is a pacifist. For Niebuhr, the just war position comes out of Niebuhr's biblically informed doctrine of man. And and he's a just war advocate out of that biblical basis. Both of them, and this is significant, are what are sometimes called realists in their understanding of man. That is, both of them have a very strong sense of man as sinner. Neither is confident that human history, as we know it, will ever see an end to the use of violence. Neither is confident that that there will ever be a sufficient number of people or a sufficient number of societies that can be sufficiently changed so that we will know war no more and that all swords will be beat into plowshares. That is to say, both of them share a common understanding of man at this point. Now, yesterday we talked briefly about a distinction between an absolute or vocational pacifism and a pragmatic pacifism. And when Yoder now holds this realist doctrine of man, it puts him in the camp of absolute, puts him against the pragmatic pacifists, and he and Niebuhr share that opposition. Let me say what I mean. For Yoder, pragmatic pacifism, and just to sort of pick up on that from yesterday, pragmatic pacifism said that pacifism is right because it is the most effective way to achieve social good. You choose it because of its good consequences, because of its effectiveness as an instrument for social and political progress. Yoder, because he has this realist doctrine of man, says that violence is in fact often more efficacious for short-term gains. Yoder would say that. So he opposes pragmatic pacifism because he thinks effectiveness cannot be the criterion. If you tally up the record, pragmatic pacifism doesn't stand up very well because we're sufficiently sinners.
Jacob Burckhardt in his work has this list of this was a good war and this was a bad war.
Huh.
So, yeah. Western European history.
Yeah, yeah. Sure, sure. Now, the just war people, in other words, agree with the order that the violence can be sometimes efficacious for short-term gains and ought to be, in those cases, might be legitimate. What I'm saying here, let me just read Yoder against the pragmatic pacifists. The point, he says, is not that one can attain all of one's legitimate ends whenever without violent means. That's a pragmatic pacifist position, that one can attain all of one's legitimate ends without violent means. The point, rather, is that our readiness to renounce our legitimate ends whenever they cannot be attained by legitimate means itself constitutes our participation in the triumphant suffering of the Lamb. Yoder sees the real problem of human beings as our compulsiveness to make things turn out right, our compulsiveness to run history, our compulsiveness to make certain that life is organized in the way in which we want it organized. And Yoder sees the pragmatic pacifist as belonging to those who are compulsive to see history turn out right. Now, we're going to talk in a minute about what's at stake theologically here, because it's considerable. My point here is that Yoder and Niebuhr are both realists, have the same picture of human nature and the same rejection of pragmatic pacifism at this point. Different words, the pragmatic pacifists for Yoder and for Niebuhr are too optimistic about human nature. That, however, doesn't mean that Yoder isn't a pacifist, obviously. It means that he's one of a different kind. He belongs to the vocational pacifists And here he with here Niebuhr joins in applauding Yoder. Now this is what I find very interesting and significant. That people who adhere to the just war position often applaud vocational pacifists. Why? It comes out of their same doctrine of man. The ideal in this sinful world cannot be fully affected in human society. However, somebody ought to hold up that ideal. And Niebuhr would say this, must hold up that ideal even if it can never be fully translated into human institutions and into ways of life. Niebuhr, those people will be crucified if they persist in doing so. And Niebuhr understands the cross in these terms. For Niebuhr, the norm of Christian ethics is agape, or suffering love, faithful unto death, and he says that Christian vocational pacifists, if they choose that way, can expect those kinds of consequences. Only if the vocational pacifist, for Niebuhr, is a person who is trying to maintain his moral or her moral innocence is that position condemned. Their pacifist somehow makes them more righteous than others, or represents a purity of heart and action others, because Niebuhr knows that the refusal to resist evil is complicity with it. And if the absolute pacifist refuses to take up even the use of deadly force against an enormous evil such as Nazism, then that pacifist is involved in the guilt incurred by not resisting. So if the pacifist knows that and still maintains his pacifism and says, I must live up to this ideal, then Niebuhr says, fine. Thomas Merton, Observations of a Guilty Bystander. I have to tell you a friend of mine who has exactly this position, and I just found it very moving. Bishop Colin Winter, who is now bishop in exile of the Damaraland, which is part of Namibia, which is the Southwest Territory under South African rule. Colin Winter is an Anglican, white, but bishop of the native Namibians, black. He has been closely involved with those black Africans who are seriously, and Christians, who are seriously contemplating guerrilla movements against the South African regime. So some of them come out sort of just war position. Colin Winter must work with them and is himself a pacifist. He says, I must support them in this cause. The enormity of the evil of apartheid is such, and its intransigence is such, that it will not be overthrown by pragmatic pacifism. So I must support them in their cause, and yet I am guilty because I do not join them. And Winter simply sort of stays on his pacifism with the conviction that that involvement in the guerrilla movement is so easily the road to cynicism, the road to moral decay. What that can do to people is simply take them apart at the point of their moral sensibilities and sensitivities. So somebody there has to continue to hold up a higher morality, so to speak, even if it can't be translated fully into the campaign against the South African regime. So somebody there has to continue to hold up a higher morality, so to speak, even if it can't be translated fully into the campaign against the South African regime. I am saying Niebuhr, as a just war position advocate, can subscribe to and does subscribe to the absolute pacifist position, providing it isn't a way of assuring moral innocence, but is rather a way of keeping the gospel alive, healthy, as a beacon to an idealism that Christians ought never to lose. Now Yoder has the same, as a pacifist, the same stance. He is, in this sense, that he is aware of the hard question of moral complicity with evil on the part of pacifists under some circumstances, and yet he adheres to his pacifism. Where then do these two part ways? Here are some of the really heavy, I think, theological issues, and I really want you to raise questions, make comments, etc., along the way if the fog gets thicker and thicker. One of the places where they part ways is an understanding of what in theological jargon is called the relationship of faith and history. Let's say what I mean by that. In its simplest terms, it comes down to something like this. Is faith simple trust, so that Christians must do what they must do and let the consequences fall where they may? Be not anxious for the morrow. Do not resist evil with evil. Turn the other cheek. Do what you are told to do as Christians, and don't worry about what kind of outcome that has for society. Is faith a simple trust? Another way of asking that question is, Do Christians have responsibility to see that history turns out right and work toward that end? Do they have the responsibility to try and shape things so that they go as they should go in light of some ideal, maybe even ideal of the kingdom of God? If you say Christians have that responsibility to make history turn out right, then you say not so much faith is simple trust, where there isn't a concern for consequences. You say something like faith is stewardship, where consequences matters immensely. The heritage for us from the time of Constantine on has been by and large one, except for the sectarian churches, by and large one in which we have said faith is stewardship. That is, church and state have a responsibility together to build the good society. Throne and altar ought to be allies in building the kingdom of God on earth, or something of that sort. Yoder is rejecting that whole Constantinian arrangement and is saying, in effect, that faith is simple trust. That doesn't mean that Yoder is saying Christians have no responsibility for society, but it's of a particular sort, and I'll get to that.
A friend of mine wrote to a poem called To Constantine. It says, when I hear prelates blessing war, you have made Christ's church great Caesar's whore.
You're rather strong, I should think.
Right there.
In fairness to someone like Reinhold Niebuhr, I think one would say that there is a way of talking about faith as of a Constantinian kind of mentality that is responsible, which the church wouldn't necessarily read, Caesar's whore. In Niebuhr's view of things, including the Christian faith, the Christian is often forced to face, Christians are responsible for the good of the whole society. And achieving that will sometimes mean compromise with evil. Indeed, sometimes it will mean a recourse to use of violence in order to achieve a short-term solution, such as overthrowing the forces of Nazism was necessary, even though it hardly in and of itself would make Europe a good place. All right, so here we've got a major division, and it is a division between absolute pacifists and just war people on the question of the use of deadly force. Another way of talking about that is to around the question, Who is Christian ethics for? Is Christian ethics only for Christians? And you should not ask other folks to subscribe to Christian ethics. And Christian ethics ought not to be normative for non-Christians. Who is Christian ethics for? Is it Christian ethics only for Christians? Or does somehow the Christian faith embodied a claim which morally is a claim upon all, and thus we ought to seek to translate Christian concerns into laws, for example, that will impinge upon all people. In other words, Christian ethics is not only for Christians, Christian ethics is for society as a whole.
Larry, would that be contingent upon your position on a previous issue that you
just It's very closely related. There's all different ways of running around the same thing. I don't care where you start. You're talking about the same thing. And I want to circle around a little bit because I think it's a big thing and a lot of really basic theological issues at stake here. Um, Niebuhr and Yoder both agree that you can't run society with the gospel. That the Sermon on the Mount can't be the basis for civil law is another way of putting it. Now, Yoder there differs from some other pacifists. Tolstoy would be one, in which the gospel would be the basis of civil law. The gospel, in other words, for both Yoder and Niebuhr, doesn't embody a social ethic for all people, but only for those who subscribe to the gospel, only for Christians. Where then do they differ here? Yoder emphatically comes down on the side of Christian ethics is for Christians, not for others. However, he says that there is in the gospel, and by that here he means in the life, death, teachings, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and in the shape of the life of the early church, there is in the gospel a particular social ethic that is binding upon Christians. It is only for believers, but it is mandatory for them. Niebuhr belongs in that tradition which says, with Yoder, that the gospel cannot be the basis for running society. But Niebuhr is in that position which says there is not a specific social ethic for political, economic, and social life to be found in the life, death, resurrection of Jesus. There is the norm for that, suffering, love, but there isn't any filled out social ethic there. Now, if you're going to answer the argument, is there or isn't there, you're going to be involved in all sorts of other things, exegesis. I'll catch it in just a minute. I'll just finish this. Therefore, the church has... Now, there are lots of reasons why these people say there isn't a social ethic. One is the shortness of the time. Jesus and the early church expected the end of time to come very quickly, so they didn't come to terms with running society or even working into society. And they weren't caring about systems and structures and institutions, etc. They sort of lived out their lives and so on. Well, there are other kind of reasons. They have a disagreement between Niebuhr and Yoder whether there is or is not a specific social ethic. What I think needs to be said is that Yoder represents something true for many pacifists, namely that they find more of a very specific political, social ethic in the life and death of Jesus than do non-pacifists. Non-pacifists tend to find the norm for a Christian ethic in Jesus, but not the details. They insist that the early church, when it found out it had time on its hands, had to work out a social ethic in order to come to terms with living in the world for the foreseeable future, and the foreseeable future kept looking longer and longer. And then it was trying to work that out that the just war position came about. I'm afraid this is a bit confused. I think I've run several things together.
Well, it seems to me that debate is almost head-splitting because Christ is all in all, for all, in every situation. And therefore, all you have to do is really saturate yourself in the gospel and teaching, and it will follow that you will know what to do in specific situations. He couldn't possibly spell it all out. It is the norm, so pervasive that any situation is covered.
But the pacifist, like Yoder, would maintain that the gospel itself says, and it is to be seen in the specific ethic of Jesus, that one must be nonviolent, non-resistant. Whereas a Niebuhr would say, Jesus' nonviolence, non-resistance is an expression of his suffering love. We ought to act in accord with that suffering love. However, in all circumstances, it doesn't mean specifically, politically, non-resistance.
So then Bonhoeffer would say that's cheap grace.
No, Bonhoeffer switched from the pacifism to the just war tradition.
Niebuhr's longest analysis of an ancient document, it seems to me, was St. Augustine, the City of God, in which he called St. Augustine the greatest political realist that ever lived. And the essence is the City of God and the City of Man. Well, I don't want to elaborate it much there.
Well, of course, Augustine strongly influences Niebuhr at precisely that point of the realism for the doctrine of man.
Are you saying there's an identification between the City of God and the City of Man, according to Niebuhr?
No, they're different.
They're different kingdoms.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And that very thing, the contrast between the City of God and the City of Man, heavenly city and earthly city, what I'm saying is used by both pacifists like Yoder and just war people like Niebuhr to come out at different positions, depending upon the relationship of faith and history. The city that both Niebuhr and Yoder agree that there's this enormous gap between the City of God and the City of Man, and that that gap will, in history as we know it, never be closed, because of, well, simply put, sin. All right. The question is, what is the church and the Christian to be in the City of Man? And Niebuhr belongs to that long, that whole group of Christians that says we have responsibility for doing as much as we can to close that gap. But trying to close that gap will inevitably involve us in compromise with evil. Yoder says the church is to be the church, and what he means by that is to be this separated embodiment of the City of God on earth, without worrying whether your actions close that gap or not. In fact, for Yoder, the minute you start making that effectiveness, success, a criterion of your action, you've betrayed the gospel.
As Benjamin Franklin said, when fortresses and maidenheads start parleying, they're both lost.
Well, this is a dilemma I want people to tell yourself, because this comes back to Bob's difficulty between the two.
I would like to be able to solve it. I can't solve it. I don't think it can be solved.
Think you have to make your own choice there in terms of, as we said earlier, in terms of your own predisposition? Some people who are more active and more able to compromise, who are really good at this, and others who are idealists, who can stand up and hold out the beacon and say, this is what we have to do.
I would like to think that, but my problem is that both of these positions, both Niebuhr and Yoder, and again, that's again shorthand for positions. Both of them contend that something is at stake about the meaning of the faith itself. And if that's true, then one can't simply say, those of you who are better at this, do this as Christians, those of you who are better at that, do that.
Right. But assuming now that you take the first of the Yoder position, absolute pacifism, you're doing something more than just not using force. You're using a different kind of force.
Yeah.
After all, you're actively resisting evil and in no way collaborating with it.
Yeah.
In fact, this is the whole thing, that you are, the only way to overcome that evil is by the soul force.
Yeah.
Such a ground.
Is there in Yoder's position the idea that if you begin to act in the way Niebuhr
or in the just war tradition, that you're taking it out of God's hands?
That's the overtones of that position, that in fact you are, that's a measure of lack of
trust
in providence, so to speak, that God makes things, history, turn out right, that it's not in our hands to do so. However, I find in Yoder something that bothers me, and it bothers me in the arguments of almost all pacifists. The same time that they say that, they make an argument that non-violent resistance is also efficacious for achieving good. In other words, they, on the other side, start making the case for pacifism in terms of its effects. Now, Yoder is sophisticated there and draws the line more sharply than others, but I hear a lot of absolute pacifists, when they come to the end of making their case for absolute pacifism and people aren't convinced, then they say, ah, but it's the best way to do what you want to do as well. And Yoder comes close to that. I'm not sure I can pull it. I don't think I... Well, he comes close to that when he says that the way in which God works out his will in history is this... the suffering love, even to the point of non-resistance. But his implication there is we should do that too, and thereby we will participate in making things turn out the way in which they do in God's actions. Yeah, and that comes close to this other business, because the argument can easily be, therefore we ought to do it because the right method.
Can I ask another thing? We started out by saying that they both start out from a passive position, and that the just war position says only if A, B, C, and D occur is it permissible under very special circumstances to do this. This was just a very small instance that we're talking about. We really must busy ourselves with the 80% or 90% of the time when pacifism applies.
Yeah. I had this the top of the page of notes here that I think two things need to be said in sort of conclusion. One is that there are, I think, indeed some major important theological differences at stake. However, we should never lose sight of the fact, as Christians often have, that both of them have this very strong presumption against the use of violence at all, and that you really are only talking about a highly exceptional use. That doesn't mean that highly exceptional use may not entail these major theological differences. That's what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, are we going to get back to the question of whether there is a social ethic that applies to non-Christians as well as in the gospel as well as Christians? Because I was thinking of, well, if you reject that, isn't that... If we say if you look at man as being a created creature of God, Jesus, you know, tossed out the things that he says in the Sermon on the Mount and stuff, and, well, the Bible, the whole book describing man and describing man in relationship to God, then if you say that none of this applies to a person if they're not a Christian, then aren't you, in effect, being, you know, complying, well, like what Yoder and all these people are saying, you know, aren't you complying with evil? By letting it be, like, well, you can take this over into, you know, contemporary issues like war and abortion and euthanasia and all of these things, you know, like, if you're not, I don't know, the whole question of whether you should expect the rest, a non-Christian culture to, because they are still, you still do recognize that they are people made in the image of God, shouldn't you be fighting for them to still live within this ethic even though they don't?
Well, let's discuss that, and it's part of this debate, in point of fact. The answers have been all the way from what you might call a theocracy, where you attempt to not even distinguish, make any significant distinction between church and state, but build a single Christian society, and the biblical materials become the basis for the civil laws binding upon all. The Hebrews, the Israelites, might be understood in that way, at least for their own purpose. It depends, of course, upon whether they would intend that for everybody. But there have been attempts, all the way from that theocracy, where you say it doesn't matter if you're Christian or non-Christian, the biblical and Christian norms are applied for all, and those who violate are subject to the penalties of violating those. You go from there all the way to what is very close to Yoder's position, although you can go beyond that, but which says the church and Christians are a set apart people in the world, and they are to live according to this, and the rest are somehow outside the pale. Now that's not Yoder, but that's the other extreme. Let me say about Yoder at this point that he never doubts that God is Lord of both believers and non-believers, Christians, non-Christians, church and state. That's not the issue. So that in his mind, people, no matter whether they're believers or non-believers, working out their lives in society are still subject to the sovereignty of God. But there is a different and a distinct morality that is binding upon Christians, which is not binding upon them. The Roman Catholic tradition has held this for a long time. The natural law tradition in ethics is one which says that creation has its own built-in norms and morality, and that's discernible to all people through the gift of reason, and that people, whether no matter what their religious and ideological persuasion might be, are capable of putting together life in a humane way, with or without knowledge of the gospel. God created the world with that kind of orderliness, intelligibility, created people with those kinds of gifts.
They think that they're sinning, they should know they're sinning.
Well, I think the people that hold this would say even our sense of right and wrong, that's not always the same as sinning, but I think that's what you're talking about. That is apart from our political, religious, ideological traditions. Even our consciousness of good and evil is a part of creation. What I'm saying is that there's a way of talking about making rather exclusivist claims for Christians at a social ethic and leaving others to another kind of way of operating that for Yoder and others and the whole Catholic tradition is still under the authority and the sovereignty of God. So the Catholic tradition has, by and large, made this distinction between natural law ethic, which is for all people and is consonant with God's sovereignty and with creation, and a special morality for Christians, and seen those two things as the two ways in which God rules, so to speak. That avoids, in that tradition, a sharp line, that avoids saying that everybody must adhere to this special morality that's binding upon Christians. And it affirms that at the same time Christ.
Doesn't a lot of things
in gray area though? Life is one gray area. In fact, that in my mind makes things neater than they are. I mean, I think life is grayer than that.
Yeah, the neatness is certainly attractive.
Which is what Luther said. We're at the same time Christian and non-Christian. Never forget it.
Yeah, but the order underlying is so stupendous. Natural law applies, as you know, we said yesterday. Maybe unjust, the unjust, and that food is gone. I mean, the wicked don't get poisoned food, you know, and so forth. I mean, seasons follow seasons, the whole thing. I mean, the earth is there for all. But we as Christians have an additional responsibility. We don't get an additional gift. We don't get more sunshine, less rain. We have an additional responsibility to our neighbor.
You know the cynic version of that, don't you? The rain falls on the just, but not the unjust fellow, because the unjust kills the just umbrella.
What time of the day is it?
It's 7 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't have some slick and nice sort of summer. I wish I did. Oh.